Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate. And that's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
These were their last words. Their names define a movement. Their deaths a rallying cry for justice. The killing of George Floyd has protesters demanding change, led by Black Lives Matter once again.
It's time for us to stand up in George's name and say, get your knee off our necks.
The Black Lives Matter group has been fighting to be heard since 2013, and the phrase itself is now being seen on streets and screens all over the world. But how did the movement get here? How did it begin? Their message comes from an urgent need to tackle police brutality, and the statistics are stark.
Police killed more than 1,000 people in America in 2019. Black people are currently three times more likely to be killed by police, and 99%...
The
data shows that the median white family has 10 times more wealth than the average black family. Our next guest, Mirsa Baradaram, is a law professor at the University of California, Irvine. In her award-winning book, The Color of Money, Black Banks and the Racial Wealth Gap, she examines how black communities have been systematically shut out of the banking system. It's a big brick in the wall of structural racism. And our Michelle Martin has been looking into these issues even before the current crises that we've been talking about that are sweeping America. But of course, this conversation just shows how prescient these warnings have been. This conversation is part of our ongoing initiative about poverty, jobs, and economic opportunity in America. It's called Chasing the Dream.
Professor Mirsa Baradaram, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your latest book is called The Color of Money, Black Banks and the Racial Wealth Gap, and it's specifically about the role of black banks. But your work is so much more than that. One of the things that you say in the book is that the wealth gap is where historic injustice breeds present suffering, that this is rooted not just in slavery, but in the history immediately following slavery. How does slavery, which ended in 1865, have present-day consequences?
One of the things I try to do in the book is to look at the myths that we tell ourselves about sort of American capitalism and then kind of show the reality and show the gap between, right? So the myth is that once slavery was ended, there was sort of capitalism and free markets, and, you know, that since then there has been equality. And the reality is, on the economic front, the American markets were not open and capitalistic and free, right? Specifically in the protection of black property, which was never there, exclusion from certain jobs and markets. So after...
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him, see what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package gonna go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, now, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit, and it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect know-how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he would.
January 1961. After months of intermittent warfare, fighting in the Congo shows no signs of abating. Regional tensions have intensified with the continuing presence of the Belgian army. Patrice Lumumba, the father of the Congolese independence movement, was recently captured by rebel forces. His condition is currently unknown.
For 75 years, Belgian colonialism dominated almost every aspect of Congolese life. Under the guise of paternalism, Belgium restricted Congolese social mobility, political participation, and educational opportunities. Native workers, no matter how skilled, were not promoted and were paid significantly less than their white counterparts. However, in the mid-1950s, the nationalism sweeping Africa struck a nerve in the Belgian Congo. In 1958, due to rising instability, the Belgians were forced, for the first time, to permit the Congolese to form political parties, which were dominated by local tribes. But none of these could gather national support in the tribally diverse Congo. Only one party, the non-tribal Mouvement National Congolais, or MNC, succeeded on a national scale. Its strength came from the personality and power of its leader, Patrice Lumumba. Patrice Lumumba, who started adulthood as a clerk, was initially moderate on the issues of independence and reform. This changed dramatically at the 1958 All African People's Conference in Accra, Ghana, where African nationalists met to discuss the creation of an independent Pan-African community. Lumumba's contact with Kwame Nkrumah, the president and founder of Ghana, cemented his beliefs in the need for immediate independence. He came to Ghana a clerk, the head of a little-known party, and left the man who would change not only the Congo, but all of Africa. Just after the conference, bloody riots shook the city of Leopoldville. Beneath the previously calm surface, the Congo had been torn apart. There seemed to be only one way to restore order. On January 13, 1959, King Baudouin of Belgium announced that his country would grant the Congo independence. However, King Baudouin had intentionally named no date. The king planned to hold on to the Congo for as long as possible. But instead, the instability in the Congo increased as nationalist leaders, most notably Patrice Lumumba, pushed for immediate independence. The Belgians recognized negotiations were unavoidable and set a series of talks with the Congolese, the Roundtable Conference, to begin on January 20, 1960, in Brussels. The Belgians expected to take advantage of divisions among the Congolese delegates. Most seriously, the representatives from the southern province of Katanga, which controlled the majority of the country's natural resources and industry, wished to form an autonomous state. However, when the Africans landed in Brussels, they pledged to join together with Lumumba's MNC to secure immediate independence. In addition to Congolese strength, the Belgian position was weak. A strong anti-war sentiment among the Belgian youth, economic instability in the Congo, and political feuds within the Belgian government left Belgium in no position to counter Congolese demands. Independence Day was set for June 30, 1960, and the first ever Congolese national election took place over a week in mid-May. The Congo seemed to have done the impossible. A nation with only 2 years of political experience had elected its own government, dominated by Lumumba's MNC, which had been so vital in ensuring independence. Lumumba himself, now a national hero, became prime minister. Independence Day had arrived without bloodshed or the Katangan secession many had predicted. On this historic day, King Baudouin delivered his speech to the newly freed Congo.
L'indépendance du Congo constitue l'aboutissement de l'œuvre conçue par le génie du roi Léopold II, entreprise par lui avec un courage tenace et continuée avec persévérance par la Belgique.
But Lumumba was unwilling to let the king praise the evils of Belgian colonialism.
Nous avons connu les ironies, les insultes, les coups que nous devions subir matin, midi et soir, parce que nous étions des nègres. Qui oubliera qu'à un noir, on disait tu, non certes comme à un ami, mais parce qu'elle est vous honorable et réservé aux seuls blancs.
This address, the tears, fire, and blood speech, won Lumumba support in the Congo, but aggravated tensions between his country and Belgium. These tensions worsened when the Force Publique, which thought Lumumba would Africanize the army, decided to mutiny rather than remain under white officers. The force left their barracks and began to harass the wealthy whites. Even though this violence was halted with the election of black officers, Belgium still sent in its army to protect white settlers. Rather than pacifying the Congo, the Belgian presence caused further violence. To the Africans, it seemed the Belgians were attempting to take back the independence given only a week before. Lumumba tried to restore order, but his efforts were stymied by illegal and often unwarranted Belgian intervention. On July 11th, any chance of reconciliation was lost when Katanga finally seceded and Belgium supported the move. Lumumba turned to the United Nations, but Cold War tensions prevented the body from intervening. NATO members were unwilling to harm their ally Belgium by supporting Lumumba. Eventually, a compromise was hammered out in which United Nations soldiers replaced the Belgian troops in every province except secessionist Katanga. There, the UN refused to intervene in the so-called internal affair, allowing the Belgian army to remain and prop up the illegitimate regime. This forced Lumumba to invade Katanga with the force publique. The invasion, combined with his wartime restrictions of civil liberties, convinced his opponents that he had gone too far. Lumumba's chief rival outside of Katanga was Joseph Kasavubu, president of the Congo and leader of the most powerful of the tribal parties. Using an obscure law, President Kasavubu removed Lumumba and many of his ministers from office. Lumumba, in turn, called on Parliament, which removed Kasavubu. Lumumba and Kasavubu found themselves at a stalemate. Several attempts were made at reconciliation, but Kasavubu refused. In this power vacuum, Colonel Mobutu, senior commander of the Force Publique in Leopoldville, seized control and placed Lumumba under house arrest. Hoping to regain power, Lumumba attempted to flee to his center of support in Stanleyville, but was captured by Mobutu's soldiers. The Belgian government arranged for Lumumba to be flown to Elizabethville, the stronghold of Shombe's secessionist forces, ensuring his death. On January 17th, he arrived, bound, badly beaten, and missing his glasses. Now, in front of cameras, he was beaten again and forced to eat a transcript of his Independence Day speech. He was never seen nor heard from again. For 4 weeks, no news of Lumumba came out of Katanga. Finally, on February 13th, Shombe issued an obviously false statement concerning Lumumba's death. The world reacted in shock and outrage. Although the Western government saw Lumumba as a communist, to the people of the world, he was, and still is, seen as a nationalist, a hero, and after February 13th, a martyr. It is widely believed he had been killed on the evening of his arrival in Elizabethville by a firing squad commanded by Belgian officers. His body was never recovered. The remains were hacked into pieces, dissolved in acid, and burned. Without Lumumba, the Congo lapsed into a deadly civil war. Ultimately, power passed into the hands of the bloody dictator, Colonel Joseph Mobutu, who ruled by fear and violence. While Lumumba's errors played a large role in the collapse of the Congo, they were minor when compared to the actions of Belgium and the inactions of the United Nations. Lumumba played a vital role in securing Congolese independence. He was still the single strongest force of unity in the Congo. He was crucial in uniting the Congolese people enough to force the Belgians to the bargaining table at Brussels in 1960, and his leadership carried the Congo through the forced public mutinies. Today, as the Congo holds its first election since those of 1960, and as Africa struggles under the yoke of poverty and oppression, he is remembered as the embodiment of hope, unity, and the glory that should belong to Africa. His last letter, written shortly before his death, concluded, "Africa will write its own history, and to the north and south of the Sahara, it will be a glorious and dignified history. I know that my country, which is suffering so much, will know how to defend its independence and its liberty. Long live the Congo, long live Africa."
Okay. It's Monday. Super quiet around here today. The title is Baskin-Robbins, 31 Flavors of Reparations. You know, just pick your cookie cutter. Okay. Where it would be, you only need one out of the 31. But there can be 301 or 3,001 and over 3 million ways to have reparations. Anyway, so that's, you know, we found a niche that we're going to follow here, and we've talked about it, but it's real quiet here, so I'm putting it out there. If you guys want to talk about that or anything else, let me know. If not, we're going to sign off early. Okay, well, speaking of which, anyway, so you know the number, 619-768-2945. Let me know.
Say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass, high as hell and everything. Couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pull up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars these is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back out the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pulled up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. Wow. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family gonna live in there? Is they gonna, I'm gonna get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm going to do it. I'm going to bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
Okay. Today's program is titled Baskin-Robbins, 31 Flavors of Reparations. And I put that title out there because when it comes to the topic of reparations, it's a broad subject, and a lot of people have a lot of different ideas on it. Some people want a payoff from the federal government of the United States. Some people, like in California, they're working to get a state of California, a payment from the state of California, which was not even a slave state, but they're working on their brand of reparations. Some people want people to get black people in particular, get a $1.5 million payout per person, some white people, they want reparations. You know, people that have a particular Irish bloodline or something like that. And that's slave-based reparations. Because if you go to Hawaii, you have some Native Hawaiians. They want reparations. So I thought of, you know what, with all these different groups and people and titles and whatnot, that's where I came up with Baskin-Robbins. Baskin-Robbins, you got 31 flavors. At all times, you got 31 flavors of ice cream. Now, throughout the year, they switch up those 31 flavors with other flavors. I'm sure you got your basic chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry year-round. But, you know, they have jamocha and mint, pistachio. I'm not a pistachio ice cream lover, but I'm sure that might be one of the regulars. So I figure, you know what, there's got to be no less than 31 flavors of reparations. Now, the type of reparations that I would participate in, I'm not interested because, like, for instance, in Evanston, Illinois, they have a city form of reparations, all right? Not eligible to everybody who lives in Evanston, Illinois, but they have their rules. You can look them up online. But Evanston has their brand of reparations. Asheville, North Carolina, they're working on their brand of reparations at the local level. I don't know if any other states besides California are working on a statewide. You know what? New York State. New York State just passed something where they're saying that a study should be done on the prospect of reparations. So that's two states now out of the 50. That they, you know, one's working on it, and the other one's saying it's a good idea to maybe have a study done. So now, while all that's going on, and like I said, you got some white folks now that, you know, they deserve reparations. So I'm looking at, well, if I had to pick out of the 31 flavors, and it could be 301 flavors of reparations, or 3,100, you know. So I'm looking at, all right, well, if I had to do reparations, number one, now with me, I wouldn't want anything from the government. I don't want anything from the government on a local level, state, or federal. My reparations, if I was to do it, because if you look at the word reparations, it means to repair. Okay. So I'm not looking at anything that happened 200, 300, 400 years ago. I'm looking at what can I do? What can I can control right now to, and I hate to use repair, but improve would be, because when you repair something, you improve something. So let's go with that. Self-improve myself, it would be a DIY solution, do-it-yourself solution. So 2 weeks ago, well, it'll be 2 weeks ago this coming Friday, we had one of our listeners and co-hosts, Reba, she shared with us and two of her relatives about the Boos settlement, which is in Mississippi. And that land's been in the family, that 300 acres, for, well, probably well over 100 years. So as I we got to look at other towns, because there are a lot of towns in this country that not even 300 acres big. So I, and that got me looking, and in 2023, where I don't have to wait on any government or playing with relatives to get these do-it-yourself reparations. So, I guess this is my new hobby and soon-to-be lifestyle. Like a friend of mine who I went to college with, he told me about a place called Los Hermanos, Texas. Population 20 people. Then there's Draper, Texas, population 27 people. Impact, Texas, population 20 people. Champ, Missouri, population 10 people. Three Creeks, Missouri, 8 people. Dalton, Missouri, 8 people. Florida, Missouri, 5 people. Bigelow, Missouri, just has 5 people. Friedenswald, Missouri, just 2 people. Riverbend, Missouri, 3 people. Cave, Missouri, just 5 people population. Corning, Missouri, just 5 people. And then, let's see, little itty-bitty little towns in Idaho, like Warm River, Idaho, 3 people. Drummond, Idaho, 16 people. Spencer, Idaho has 37 people. Then South Dakota, Scenic, South Dakota has, and that's the name of the town, Scenic, 10 people. Radium, Kansas, 26 people. Plateau, Texas, just 5 people. Kent, Texas, 60 people. Pine Springs, Texas, 51 people. Waldron, Kansas, 9 people. Clayton, Idaho, 7 people. Bowdoin, West Virginia, 9 people. Now, let's see. Poso Park, California has a population of 9 people, and Poso Park, California is just 28 acres large. That's it, 28 acres. Then there's Delview, North Carolina, population of 5 people. That's on 72 acres. Lobo, Texas, just has 15 people, and it's just on 10 acres. And the smallest town, I ran across a series of towns that I'm looking for on my notes. That they have Here it is. All right, I found it. We talked a little bit about this last Friday. Sweat, South Dakota. Sweat, South Dakota, a legitimate town, legal and everything, is just 6 acres big. That's it, 6 acres big. And then Casas, Texas, is just 5 acres big. So I said, you know what, that's my reparations right there. Because at one time, you take a place like Houston, Texas. Houston, Texas, which has got over 1 million people there in Houston, Texas. Houston, Texas, originally, it started with 2 brothers and their wives, or one of their wives. But let's just say 2 brothers started Houston, Texas. Pembroke, excuse me, not Pembroke. What do you call it? Most towns around the globe started with a handful of people. You know, a lot of the black town, historical black townships started with family members. You know, it could have been 2 or 3 families. Hopkins Park, Illinois, depends on who you talk to. If you talk to one person, they'll say it started with one family of about 15 kids. I talked to somebody else last year about Hopkins Park, Illinois. And yep, you listen to them. And they live in Hopkins Park. I'm going to see if I can get them on here. It started with, now name them. It started with three families. So if you got 3 families and let's say they all had, 10 plus kids each, that's over 30 people that they started. Somebody that we, the Freedom Georgia Initiative, 3 black women, and they got 19 families together, So, I mean, it started with three, and then it went to 19 families, which out of the 19, it's well over 50 people. But it initially was three women that ran across the patch went. So, and in some of these towns, at one time had larger populations, some didn't. I've run across a bunch of towns that have, I mean, we're talking about populations under 50 people. Some of these at one time had more people, but some of these towns are family owned. So that's the way they want it. Blood relatives only. Some of these towns at one time and even could have been industry based. They decided, you know what, and then some of those towns, like Hershey, Pennsylvania. Hershey, Pennsylvania, you know, was a town that the guy with Hershey, the candy bar people, he wanted his employees to live in the same place, have school in the same place, and, of course, their population grew. But there's a lot, put it this way, there's a whole lot of little, I would call micro towns in Germany, they would call them Dorf, D-O-R-F. Dorf means in German, small village. So there's a lot more, and this is what I call the real United States. And a lot of these places have been around for quite a while. So, matter of fact, I'll probably get my phone to open back up. All right, Edge Hill, Georgia, just 22 people. Let's see. Let's go to, matter of fact, Yoder, Kansas. Now, Yoder's got a, not a micro population, but this is what I say, give an example of real United States. Now, Yoder has a population of 163 people. And Yoder is an unincorporated community, which I think those are the best ones. Everyone I read off to you was an incorporated city or town or village, whatever you want to call it, for the most part. Some were, some aren't. But anyway, Yoder, of the community that arises from its Amish founder, Valentine or Valentine Yoder, Y-O-D-E-R. And like I say many times, everything starts with one. All right. Now, I don't know if Valentine Yoder had his wife and family with him, but they say here, Valentine Yoder was the founder. That's one person. The first post office in Yoder was established in November 1889. Let's see. The community was home to the former Naval Air Station, Hutchinson, later renamed Hutchinson Air Force Station, currently named Sunflower Aerodrome, Gilderport. Let's see. Essentially, Yoder is an Amish community. It's an Amish town. If you go on their website, you know, Yoder's made up of family businesses. They install solar. They build barns. They have a restaurant. It's a group of Amish families who are basically entrepreneurs. And Yoder, Valentine Yoder, well, he bought some land, and he's not unusual. He's not an outlier. There's a lot of Valentine Yoders. Valentine Yoders, because there are quite a few. I mean, if you type in any search engine, map Amish communities in the United States, and you'll see where they are. So there are a lot. There are quite a few of them in the United States. If you type in And, you know, like, say, Yoda's 165 people. That's it. So some people might ask, you know, well, how can a town that small survive? What? They do it. And they're not unusual. Like I said, if you type in Mennonite communities in the United States or global, and you'll be amazed at these little itty-bitty towns. But they, many of them have, they have an economic engine. They're farmers. They're producing something. I was in West Virginia some years ago, and this one particular family, one of their primary income engines, I don't know if it's the only one, is they sell Christmas trees. I mean, but you have to come out. They have a Christmas tree farm. You have to come out, and you pick out your own tree, you cut it down, and you haul it away. That's, you know, you pay them for the privilege of going on their line and picking up a tree. And, you know, they replant everything and all that. And I don't know what other economic engines they have, but that was in that particular town that I visited. So I'm looking at, you know, the, and like I say, the Booth family, I mean, they have a settlement, which is a town, and that's 300 acres. So every town that I read to you today is under, I would say a good portion of them are under 40 acres big. You know, 5 acres, 6 acres. There's a bunch of them, 20 acres, 12 acres. These are towns. So anyway, that's what I consider. If you're looking for reparations, I suggest DIY it. And, you know, it's what you have to do now. No government is going to hand you, you know, But to do it yourself, man. But like I say, the matter of fact, let's go to one more before we go to the phone lines. Let's go to Friday, Sweat, North Dakota. That's SWETT, Sweat, North Dakota. All right. And seeing a lot of these places, these people are not going to a town, or they don't form the town because their job, they go and they make their job. All right, anyway, Sweat is an, this is in South Dakota, is an unincorporated former town of Bennett County, South Dakota in the United States. All right, it was put up for sale. Nobody's found a buyer yet. Okay, hold it. Let's go to another town. Let's see. All right, Sweat is 6 acres big. Here's a, you know what, Luckenbach, Texas. I don't know if you guys remember the song, Luckenbach, Texas. I need to load that up. I can't do it today, though. Let's go to Luckenbach, Texas. All right, Luckenbach, Texas is a town in Texas. They have a population of 3 people, a song that was a hit record. All right. It's in Gillespie County, Texas, named for Carl Albert Luckenbach, son of the early settler Jacob Luckenbach. A town known for a venue of country music and of German Texas heritage. Currently, there's 3 people there. On December the 15th, 1847, a petition was submitted to create Gillespie County, Texas, in 1848. The Texas legislature, formerly Gillespie County and Bexar and Travis counties, is the oldest building in the Combination General Store. Okay, let's see. The community first name, it was first named Great Creek and later renamed after Engel's husband, Carl Albert Luckenbach. They later moved to another town and became Albert, Texas. Luckenbach was first established as a community trading post. Okay, so that was their commerce line. One of few that never broke peace treaty with the Comanche Indians for whom they traded. All right. Let's look at, hold on, this is another little town in this. It's Carl Albert Luckenbach. There's a postmaster in Luckenbach, Texas. But later he moved to Albert, Texas. What's going on with Albert, Texas? Albert, Texas is a ghost town. Oh, well, but they have a population of 7. Let me screenshot this one. I went to undergraduate school. I'm so glad I went. Texas is a very fascinating state. Okay. Let's go back to Albert Luckenbach. Albert Luckenbach, his distinction, he's known for having 2 cities in Texas named after him. So Luckenbach, Texas, because his name is Carl Albert Luckenbach. So Luckenbach, Texas was named after him, and Albert, Texas is named after him. So anybody within the sound of my voice can do the same as Carl Albert Luckenbach. You can go out here in the United States and probably many countries around the planet, but for the sake of this conversation, in the United States, you can go out here and find you a patch of land. The lowest town as far as that I've found so far, and then at one time you had towns that, and I haven't done all my research on it, but like in Vermont, they had a listing of 1-acre towns and 10-acre towns. All right, 1-acre towns and 10-acre towns. So there's a whole lot more Luckenbach, Texases and Albert, Texases than there are New York cities. Now, granted, you're not going to have a metro or subway in Luckenbach, Texas. You're not going to have a bus route in Luckenbach, Texas. There's not going to be a Greyhound station, bus station in Luckenbach, Texas, or a megabus. There's no international airport in Luckenbach. But you know what? Back then when they started these towns, you didn't have that anyway. However, man, for thousands of years, before there was modern motor vehicles, people, I mean, even what in the, what's that TV show, Roots? Even Chicken George managed to get on a ship, not a slave ship this time, he managed to get on a ship and spend time in England for a while before he came back to the United States. So Genghis Khan conquered a whole lot of land with just horses. So we can get to any place we want to get to. Okay. Let's see. I had to dialogue with these people. All right, now. Let's see, before we go to the phone lines, was there any other, and I'll probably discover 5 to 10 new ones every day. T. Tent City. Let me get this right. Tent City. All right, Tent City, Tennessee. That's not a permanent place, but it was also called Freedom Village. And a lot of these towns, how did they get started? You know, after a person, you know, got the land and everything, the first structure that would go up in a lot of these places would be a tent. No skyscrapers or not just, but we're talking about a lot of these towns started with humble beginnings. Matter of fact, let's take a look at Houston, Texas now. Houston, Texas, we're looking at the history of Houston. Okay, Houston, which is the most populous town, in the state of Texas. Over 2 million people live in Houston. All right, let's get to the history of Houston. All right, Houston occupies land that was home to the Karankawa and another group of indigenous Native Americans, at least 2,000 years before the first European settlers arrived. The tribes are almost non-existent today. This was most likely because of foreign disease and competition with various settler groups in the 18th and 19th century. However, the land then remained largely uninhabited from the late 1700s until settlement in 1830s, early settlement to the 20th century. All right, now this is what we go by in this country when the white man showed up or European showed up. Right? The Allen brothers, okay, Augustus Chapman Allen and John Kirby Allen explored town sites on the Buffalo Bayou and Galveston Bay. According to historian David McComb, the brothers on August 26, 1836, bought from Elizabeth E. Parrott, wife of T.F.L. Parrott and widow of John Austin, the south half of the Lower League, 2,214 acres, granted to her by her late husband. They paid $5,000 total, but only $1,000 of this in cash. Notes made up the remainder. This is amazing. Okay, so before the Allen brothers, okay, once again, Elizabeth E. Parrott, wife of, oh, doggone it. Okay, wait a minute. I hit the wrong button. So we're talking about a widow. The widow received something from her husband. Where is it? Okay, here it is, history. Sorry, T.F.L., and I don't see any backstory on him. T.F.L. Parrott and the widow of John Austin. So we got two people here. The south side half of the Lower League, okay, they sold 2,214 acres. All right, they purchase price was $5,000. The brothers only had $1,000. The rest of it, today we would call that owner financing. They carried a note for $4,000. And I guess they had to make monthly payments or whatever they agreed on. All right, now, after the brothers, I told you, everything starts with one. okay, in this case, one and a widow, and then they sold it to the Allen brothers, Augustus Chapman and John Kirby. All right. Now, the Allen brothers first ran, now after they got the land, because these guys were speculators, the Allen brothers ran their first advertisement for Houston. That's the name they gave their land. All right. Just 4 days later, in the Telegraph and Texas Register, naming the notional town in honor of President Sam Houston. They successfully lobbied the Republic of Texas Congress to designate Houston as a temporary capital, or agreeing to provide the new government with a state capitol building. About a dozen persons resided in the town at the beginning of 1837. So Houston, Texas, one of the largest cities in the world today, is in the top 10 largest cities in the United States today, and the largest city in the state of Texas right now, for the sake of this conversation, started with the Allen brothers. And by 1837, it had 12 people living there. But that number, now I'm reading back on Wikipedia, but that number grew to about 1,500 by the time convened in Houston for the first time that May. The Republic of Texas granted Houston incorporation on June 5th, 1837, James S. Holman became its first mayor. In the same year, Houston became the county seat of Harrisburg County, now Harris County. All right, anyway, long story short, it started by two people. Oh, here's something interesting. The majority of enslaved people in Texas came with their own owners from the older slave states. Sizable numbers, however, came through domestic slave trade. Long story short, a lot of those slaves ended up owning their own town, starting their own town. All right, so Houston got large. Okay. The brothers, you know, they purchased over 2,000 acres of land. That's a lot of land. And they ran an ad within a week. And, you know, after running the ad, they got 12 people. Now, granted, they did all this without social media. Now, a lot of the little towns I named, like I said, some of those towns are owned by families. Some of those towns were originally put together so they can, anything from bed sheets to clothes to furniture, you name it. Many were farming communities. But the numbers of, you know, 5 people in the town, 10 people in the town, 30 people in town, maybe 60 or 70 people in town, all these numbers are below 100. These are things that if you, honest about it, if you put it on Facebook Marketplace, every time I place something on Facebook Marketplace, within a day, and it's a day, not even the so part, I get at least 100 inquiries. That's just on Facebook Marketplace. And I'm sure some of you out there that have done Facebook Marketplace or Clubhouse. You can pick up people on Clubhouse too. Or Craigslist, or if you're in Canada, Kijiji, or your local newspaper, or if you put someone on Airbnb, social media is a real way to. So I'm saying all this to say this. You can do like the Bootstrap. You don't need 300 acres, you know, but some of these towns are 5 acres big, 6 acres big, some are 12 acres. All well under 40 acres big, but they have their own town. And you can build, like some of them, like many of them have done, you can build an economy around that itsy bitty little town. And what we'll be doing from here on out is every day we'll announce one new one right here in the United States. At least one new. I read off at least 20 today. So, okay. And that's my version of what I call DIY or Baskin-Robbins reparations. That's something you can do yourself. You don't have to march a protest. And you can go from there, and when you get a chance, go on YouTube and punch in, matter of fact, I got to get the artist's name, Luckenbach, Texas. That was Luckenbach, Texas. Waylon Jennings. he got a hit off of it. What were the charts on that? Because I remember when that came out, Luckenbach, Texas song. Let's see, by Waylon Jennings. It was released in 1977. I was in college then. And charts. How did it do on the charts? Chart history. Ah, the song. All right. Waylon Jennings scored the biggest hit of his career when he, Luckenbach, Texas, topped the Billboard Hot Country Songs on May 21st, 1977. The song remained at number one for 6 weeks. It's the longest reign of any song from Waylon's catalog. And Luckenbach, Texas has, matter of fact, let's go back to Luckenbach, Texas. Let's see what's happening in Luckenbach today. Okay, Luckenbach is an incorporated community 13 miles from Fredericksburg. I think I had somebody on here from Fredericksburg, 13 miles from all right, let's see, Gillespie. Luckenbach, the town is known as a venue for country music and for its German Texas heritage. The population is 3 people. It was in the Guinness Book of World Records. Let's see. Luckenbach, now here, with only 3 people, okay, Luckenbach hosts live music events each weekend. So here's a town of 3 people that they have a revenue going because each weekend they hold music events. On Sundays, it's common for visitors to bring instruments and take turns performing informally with others in the crowd. Occasionally, local and regional celebrities drop by. There are recreational vehicle camping spots nearby, along with a small creek. It is also set up for washer fishing. Now, hold it. I guess I missed that. Washer pitching. That's sort of like horseshoes. They got a whole Wikipedia thing on it. Okay. So Luckenbach, Texas, population 3. Let me see. How big is Luckenbach? Luckenbach. So they have weekend events. That brings in revenue for the town or the community there of 3. All right, let's go to Airbnb. Because somebody might have something set up. I know it. All right, Luckenbach is Airbnb. And studying these little itty towns, you can get some simple business out here. All right, Luckenbach, they have vacation rentals. Now, this is on Airbnb. Okay, Luckenbach, Texas on Airbnb, with pictures and everything. They got somebody right near Luckenbach in Cottage in Fredericksburg, $131 a night. Another one for $207 a night. Another one for $105 a night. All right, so in Luckenbach, Texas, population 3. Their bread and butter comes from hosting events on weekends. So they get a revenue stream from that and then accommodations. And let me see how big is Luckenbach, Texas. Okay, Luckenbach is 3rd time. All right, well, look. It can't be but so big. Like, so you got 3 households there. All right, hold on. Wait a minute. Now it comes through. Right. Let's see. Texas. Okay. Oh, man, I don't want that. Okay. Okay, Texas. Okay, now let's see if I can find it. I'm looking for the area. Oh, it's over 1,700 towns here. Wait a minute. Okay, I'm not able to find the area of it. But, okay, well, we're going to revisit Luckenbach at another time. I couldn't find the area of it. All right, so food for thought. Let's see now. Let's go back to Blog Talk here. But yeah, Luckenbach, interesting town. 3 people and to generate income, they have Weekend Events. Weekend Events. And that song probably, what Waylon Jennings wrote that song. Now, I'm sure he wrote that song and got it to be a hit record. He had never been to Luckenbach, Texas before he wrote the song. He just wrote it all based on whatever people say. I'm sure he's been there if he's still living. He's been through there since. But that song, I'm sure it was very good advertising for that particular town. So they accommodations and music events on weekends. But I don't know how the town's laid out and all that, so I have to do more research on that. Not for everybody, because as I've mentioned many times on here before, 86% of the population of the United States occupies only 3% of the available landmass. So people are addicted to the, like New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Houston, Texas, Seattle. People are addicted to comfort and convenience. Like in New York City, you don't need a car. In a lot of your big cities, you might not need a car. But, you know, people are addicted to the comfort and convenience. They want to be in a place that's got a metro system. They want to be in a place that's got a bus line. They want to be in a place where there's a fire department. They want to be in a place, you know, where there's a hospital. A big-size trauma-based type thing. So they want to be near a Whole Foods. Okay, these people are not going to grow their own food. These people, even if they, you know, because not everybody lives in a remote. Here's what a lot of people need to remember. A lot of people, a lot of these little itty-bitty towns, in between these itty-bitty towns and your big megapolis towns, there's a lot of little, what I would call, connector communities. You know, the other towns that might have 500 people, 1,000 people, they're like, for instance, in between, I mean, wherever you're at right now, if you're not in a big town, if you wanted to go to, let's say a big town might be 30 minutes away, it might be an hour away, whatever it might be, you're going to, more than likely, you're going to pass through a lot of little other towns till you get to that one big town. So although you might live in a town that has 20, 25, maybe 50 to 100 people, you know, there might be a clinic. If there's not a clinic in town, you know, 10 to 15 minutes away, there might be a clinic, a medical clinic, and or a hospital with a trauma unit there. The airport might be 30 minutes away. The airport might be 45 minutes away. So there's a lot of little connector towns in between a lot of these tiny micro cities that, I mean, towns that have 2 people, 3 people, 5 people, 20 people, 60 people. There's a lot of those in between whatever destination that you start with to the one big town. And if you look at it, let's take Texas. Texas has three out of the 10 largest cities in the United States, and pretty soon, because Austin, Texas is knocking at the door of 1 million people. They're over 900,000 now. Texas has Dallas, over 1 million people, Houston, 2 million people, and San Antonio, over 1 million people. Texas has three of the 10 largest cities in the United States. Soon, by the next census, it might be 4, because Austin is still growing. But let's take a look. So in between those three big cities that I just named, and let's go in Austin, make it four big cities. There's a lot of little itty-bitty towns in Texas, a bunch of them. They're more Luckenbach, Texases, population three, than there are Houston, Texas, or Dallas, Texas, or whatever. Places where basically you can build a house to the specs that you want it to be. You don't have to worry about a code enforcement officer like that or nothing like that. There's a bunch of towns like that all throughout Texas. And I've lived in Texas for 4 years. I went to undergraduate school in Texas, up in the Panhandle. So, but in that like, I'm in Florida. Once you get outside of Broward and Dade County, Fort Lauderdale and Miami, then throw in Palm Beach County, where you have Boca, where the rich live, Orange County, or hold it, see, we got Broward County, Dade County, Orange County with Disney is, that's got, Orange County has over 1 million people. Pinellas, where St. Petersburg is, and Tampa, Hillsborough County, that's five counties, Tallahassee and Jacksonville, which is in Duval, has seven counties. Now, Florida has 67 counties. Once you get out of those seven counties that I just named, Florida is rural. Cows, horses, pastures, horse ranches. The real Florida is not Disneyland or Disney World or Universal. That's not really Florida. That's a tourist trap in Florida, but that's not the real Florida. Miami, South Beach, you know, the TV show Miami, those are in Florida. They're not, that's not what I would call the real Florida. Hold the people, I'll be right back in a moment.
It was almost 2 years ago that I started work on a small log cabin in the northern Canadian bush. And it has been exactly a year since I closed the cabin door for the last time and moved away. Finally, I got the chance to return, and I am anxious to see how the cabin has fared the last four seasons on its own. While most parts of North America are enjoying mild spring weather with no snow, my aluminum snowshoes are falling through waist-deep powder in temperatures of minus 20 degrees Celsius. Although this looks like January weather, would you believe that this is late April? It's been a long, hard winter here. Lots of snow and a solid month of minus 40 degree temperatures. There were even a few days that registered right around minus 50. It seems that the lynx population has been hit the hardest this winter. Several locals have reported that their dogs have been attacked by lynx along the hiking trails. Normally, lynx avoid this sort of contact with bigger dogs and humans, but the prolonged cold temperatures have forced them to make desperate decisions. It wasn't far from here that I spotted a mother lynx and her two cubs last year. And of course, I didn't have my camera ready at the time. On my way into the cabin, yet another lynx had silently stalked behind me for a short distance, but it eventually turned off my path and took a different direction. And I wouldn't have noticed it at all if it weren't for the footprints it left behind over my fresh tracks. In building the cabin, I wanted it to be simple for two reasons. Number one, because of the cabin's location, I knew that I'd be having to do everything by hand. Getting the equipment and supplies in, moving and hoisting the logs would all have to be done with good old-fashioned manpower. And reason number two, I didn't have a lot of money to work with, simple as that. And in this complicated world, simple just seems to offer more.
Okay. All right. Had to do something with the dog real quick. Anyway, so going back to the original title of this podcast today, Baskin-Robbins Reparations, 31 Flavors of Reparations. I'm just throwing it out there that anybody within the sound of my voice can rustle up what they need to get 1 acre of land. Let me put it this way. Anybody of a sound mind, I'll put it that way. And if they want to, this is not for everybody because there are 1 acre towns out here. I named at least 2 or 3, 5 or 6 acre towns out here. Everybody's not cut out to be a pioneer or whatnot, but it is a way that God knows countless numbers of people. Like I say, some people just, they want to have their own little patch of dirt and have, like, Lucanbach, Texas, populate. If you can't get no American dream than that, I mean, come on, 3 people, and they have weekend events, and that works for them. Other people might have dreams might be a little bit more grandiose, but Houston, I read earlier in this case, Houston started with essentially two brothers who ran an ad. And, you know, those two, and then it went up to like maybe 180-something or whatever. And now it's over 2 million. That didn't happen overnight, though. All right, so many towns around this in the United States as well as globally, were basically trading spots. I imagine Chicago, you know, now, which Native Americans were there before DuSable got there. But for some reason, with history, they go back to whatever year that they want to go. So DuSable, who was a Haitian man, well, of Haitian descent, I imagine he found here's a nice little place where it's quiet, but I can still trade here. There's plenty of game to hunt, fertile soil, plenty of water. He found a nice little spot, and once again, although there were people there before DuSable, but going by our history, everything is gauged on European history. Who was the first European, although DuSable wasn't European? Chicago started with one, DuSable. And other people ran across this, I'm going to call it watering hole. And then it just grew. You know, so some places, because some people start little townships or settlements or whatever you want to call them for the sole intent of building up an empire. Others, they didn't plan on it, but it got big. Whereas many other places, they, you know what, I just want something for my children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren, like with Reba, with the Boost Settlement, 300 acres, founded by Zach Boost. They're still in the family today. So, like I say, reparations, I look at it as Baskin-Robbins. What form do you want? Do you want to I've been talking about DIY reparations today. But there's some people that want reparations coming from their local city, or they want it coming from the federal government. Or like in California, you have some in that state that want the state of California. I'm saying they're right. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm just saying that's their flavor of reparations. There are over 31 flavors. I just talked about my favorite flavor. So other people might have their flavor. So whatever flavor works for you, go for it. All right, that's my rant for today. And like I say, every day from here on out, we'll be naming at least one town, new town, that has like a little itty-bitty population and a backstory, if we can find it, on why the town got started. And you'll be amazed at some of the entrepreneurial stories that are behind some of these places. You know, like what, Luckenbach, Texas. They have weekend events. You know. And I imagine a lot of Amish, Yoder, Texas, and there's a lot more stories like Yoder, so. In any event, that's it on that end. Okay, now, if anybody's got any questions or comments or different topics, 619-768-2945. Particularly if you have any comments on Baskin-Robbins reparations. So, anyway, I think the Baskin-Robbins method or Baskin-Robbins philosophy is quicker. And like with the Freedom Georgia Initiative, you can't get any better. Three women in Metro Atlanta, they discovered 96 acres or 97 acres 2 hours outside of Atlanta, and then they get 19 families together. And each one of those 19 families has at least 2 acres of land each. Okay? That's something that anybody within the sound of my voice can do, if they want to do that. Okay, area code 410, your mic is open.
Hotel, Brother L.A.
Hotel, good morning.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you clear. Yeah, we can hear you clear.
Yeah. Well, you know, in life, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. You know, when I was in school, I guess it was a proverb or what you want to call it. The grasshopper saw the ant drinking water on a leaf. And as he observed the ant, the ant looked like it was very tasteful and looked like he was enjoying it. So the grasshopper decided that he'd do the same thing as the ant. And he started drinking his water from a leaf, and he perished in the process. Well, the story goes like this: year, what's good for the ant, what's good for the goose is not good for the gander. Yeah. Your reparations is DIY. That's something
right,
that
works for me.
That works for you.
Yeah,
but
that's for me. I'm not saying anybody else.
Yeah. But there's other folks that say, hey, look, you know, I have a different objective. And with that being the case, I can't say which one is better or which one is worse. I fall on the side of the ones that, hey, there's been a wrong committed here, and justice needs to be served. And it doesn't mean that I don't do DIY. It just means that I can do both and with that being said, you know, hey, everybody has their own beliefs and their own little perks, but that's the way I see it.
And, 31 flavors. And you pick which one you want to go.
Yeah, you know? But I don't discourage. I don't look down on one or the other. You know, I just go with what pleases me. I don't criticize, nor do I go in and recommend. I just know what's good for me and what side I want to be on. But, you know, you have a lot of people.
Right.
Their thing is, hey, if I like this, then you are wrong. And they're not flexible
right.
enough to understand that this world is made up with a whole lot of people, with a whole lot of opinions.
Well,
and with that being said,
you're right.
You
that's
can't
why.
Dictate.
You're
no,
right. That's why I named it Baskin Robbins, because you can go to Baskin Robbins and you can order a scoop on home or whichever way you want it. You can order a scoop on a, you can order vanilla, a scoop of vanilla, a scoop of chocolate, a scoop of strawberry, or any other combinations that you want. And
yeah.
if you're happy with that, you're happy. Right for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, your flavor reparations works for you. You can get yourself, and you can still, if you want to go after something on a city level, or state level, or federal level, have at it. I'm saying everybody's right. Pick whatever flavor you want and go for it.
Well, I will say this. Now, you can disagree with me if you want to, because we disagree on just about 90% of everything you have to say about reparations, maybe 98%. What you do personally to progress and make sure that you survive, not survive, but what you do to uplift your standard of living personally is not reparations. Now, the thing is, this is something that you do personally, which you would do anyway. And what I do to go in and make sure that, hey, look, I'm a progress in life and I want to be prosperous, that is not reparations. That is personal. That is something that you do to make sure that, hey, look, you're success in life. Now, reparations is not something that people depend on to be successful in life. Reparations is to repair the damage, which is two different things. Now, I don't know about you, but that's where I draw the distinction. And for someone to say, well, you know, hey, my reparations is I go out here and I invest. No, you're doing that on a personal level. You do that anyway, regardless. And it's not to go in and make up for what has happened to a group of people over a number of years. Now, we can disagree on that, but that's the way I see it. And I think it's very disingenuous
okay.
for someone to go in and do that.
The reason why, another reason why I said the 31 flavors, Baskin-Robbins reparations, which has 31 plus flavors, is because, now just like you and everybody who's listening to this live stream, we've heard a whole lot of conversations on reparations. And people have, a lot of people have, you can have 10 people with 10 different definitions of what reparations means to them. Like in California, which was not a slave state, there are people that want a $5 million payout. There are other people that, you know, with their definition of reparations, you know, they want, you know, compensation another way, maybe tax breaks, permanent tax breaks on a local, state, and federal level. So that's why I named it Baskin-Robbins because if you look up the word reparations, it means to repair. Now,
exactly.
I'm looking at when you lose something. So me now, this is me personally. I don't think I'm broke. I don't think I'm suffering from PTSD, which stands for post-traumatic slave syndrome. I don't think I have that. I've only seen a cotton plant probably less than 10 times in my life so far. I remember I was driving up to Atlanta once out of Florida, and I ran across a cotton field, and I pulled my car over to the side, and I was about to pick just one little pluck of cotton, but I didn't do it because I got paranoid. I said, you know what, if somebody sees me picking somebody, they might say I was stealing something. So I just looked at it up close, but I didn't pick it. But there's a lot of different definitions, and I haven't heard anybody. I mean, I guess they came to some, like in Evanston, Illinois, the city of Evanston, they came up with a definition of reparations. Now, how that's working up out there, I don't know. California, I think it's going to be a while before that happens. If it does happen, New York State, they just came out with something that maybe they will have a study, but we know there's a lot of years between a study, particularly if you're looking for a five. But I'm looking at now, what can I do now, using what laws are on the books? If I want to go out and get $5 million worth of whatever, I can. So that's what I call a Baskin Robbins.
Okay,
pick your favor. What works for you?
But here's the deal. Now, if you really listen to what you just said, there's a whole lot of opinions about how reparations are supposed to be administered or what you want in a reparations demand. Okay? That's within the argument of reparations and people that are sitting down trying to decide what they want as far as a reparations compensation. That has nothing to do with you personally trying to achieve something on your own. That will not replace what the damage was as far as chattel slavery was in this country. And that's where you have to, that's where I draw the distinction. You're mixing apples and oranges. Yeah, look at me. I go out here and I try to do a lot of things to make sure that I'm prosperous and to build wealth. But that has nothing to do with justice and fairness. That's two different subjects. Now, on this thing about you don't suffer from post-traumatic slave disorder, here's the deal. You're damaged, whether you know it or not. Now, you may not think so, but you're damaged. And the thing is, you might be in denial or you may not recognize it. But the thing is, over the years, what has happened to our people has had some effect on the way you see life and the way you perceive life to be. Now, you may not own up to it, but yeah, you've been damaged, no doubt about it. You're still being damaged. And the thing is, for you not to see it, that means that you're not aware of your surroundings or the environment that you're in. And the thing is, if you want to get into it, we can sit down and we can discuss this, which would take a whole lot of your time.
Now,
could you give
an example of possible damage?
Well, tell me how you figure you're not damaged.
All right, all right. In 2023, right now, today.
Okay.
Could you give an example to, let's say, the typical black person in the United States? Could you give an example of a damaged person today?
Sure. But you can't give me a definition of why you're not damaged, because you made a statement. But now if you can prove to me that you're not damaged, I'll come back and I'll show you how you are damaged. prove to me that slavery has not had an effect on your family and your upbringing.
Well, I don't think it has. For instance, now this is just my point of view.
That's all.
Now, in my lifetime, all right, I was born 2 years after Emmett Till met his demise. That's 2 years.
Year
I happened in 1955, but I came along in 57. Okay. Now, in my lifetime, I've never had to.
I don't mean to interrupt you. How many years now? Count to me from 1865 to the time that Emmett Till was killed. How many years had your people had our people been out of slavery?
Oh, Jesus, wait a minute.
I think 110 years, right? If I'm not mistaken, black folks had been out of slavery 100 years in 1965. And he died in, what, 1955? So I think black folks have been out of slavery.
Beasley, you there? Reba, can you hear me?
Yes, I'm here. Doc is on the line as well. He wanted to announce
okay,
our
all right.
event. Hey, look.
Okay.
Emmett Till,
all right. Go ahead, Beasley.
Black folks have been out of slavery in 1965 only 100 years. Now, you said Emmett Till was killed in 1955, right?
55. I came along in 57.
Okay, look. When Emmett Till died, black folks had only been out of slavery 90 years. So now you're telling me there are not some lingering effects on black people in 90 years. Out of slavery now.
Okay, let me, I'm giving it to you from my life experience. Now, in second grade, I spent the year with my grandparents in New Orleans. All right. Now, my grandfather, on my mother's side, he was a blind man. I never heard him once complain about white folks. He never used a cane or a walker. He knew his house and surroundings that well. He didn't make no excuses about himself. You didn't even think he was blind, but he was blind, 100%. My grandmother only had like a sixth grade education, and they both raised seven children together, no excuses. My great-grandmother, she lived on 88 acres. She lived to be like 102. No excuses. The 80 acres is still in the family. I didn't hear no victim stuff. I didn't hear from them. Now, that's my background. No excuses. And they grew up with sitting in the back of the bus.
How you doing, Gunner?
They grew up with...
You don't remember me, man, but I remember you. I used to work over at DRMO.
Okay.
How you been doing?
Well,
you looking good. Good seeing you again. What did
right,
you say
so,
after the LA?
Oh. No, I said I grew up, my grandfather was blind. I never heard him make an excuse. I heard my grandmother was 60. They grew up with lynchings. They never brought it up around me.
What did you say?
I never heard my mother mention the drinking out of the water fountain, the white one and the color. I never experienced none of that.
No, listen. What did you say your grandfather experienced?
I'm sure he was blind. He could, but I never saw him make up an excuse, right? And like I say, they grew up around lynching, and all that kind of stuff. They grew up around the colored water fountain and the white water fountain. I didn't experience, I never had to sit at the back of the bus. I never had to sit at the back of anything.
That's right.
I'm not talking
and
about my experience
you,
now.
And why didn't you? Why didn't you have to experience those things?
Well, because of people before me paved
Thank
the
you.
Way so I wouldn't
Thank
have
you.
To experience none of it.
Hey, brother, like, can you hear me, my audio?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, Reba, go ahead. What's your comment, Reba?
I mean, it sounds like you weren't reared as a young man to make a speech about race or what have you, and the fact that you do not live your life as a So slavery never really ended, except for those who were physically enslaved. The other trauma that generally is possible passed down from generation to generation. Psychological trauma, emotional trauma, energy transfer. It seems like your family offer you that trauma. Even if your grandparents or great grandparents have experienced it, they didn't offer you the trauma. So that's a healthy way of the slavery experience is full captivity and mental and physical captivity. And many, many
right.
blacks are still mentally enslaved because of the trauma that their families and generations passed it on. My grandmother did not allow me. When I was in college, my dad was okay with, hey, you go and get you some public benefits and help you so you can eat while you're in college. You're not going to be living here with that. My father was like,
right.
you're not going to be living here with that. And she was serious. So,
yeah, Bees, let me ask you this question. About man, the black man, who he's supposed to bring some Pampers home for the baby. Now, he comes home without the Pampers, and then his mother, his wife, or baby mom, whatever you want to call it, says to him, well, why didn't you bring the Pampers home? You know we ran out. And he comes back with this. Well, you know, I'm suffering post-traumatic slave syndrome. The white man's got his foot on his neck. That's why I didn't bring the Pampers home. Now, how do you think that's going to end up for that man?
Brother L.A., you know what? I know you're more intelligent than that. I know you're a college graduate. And you've seen a lot in life. I know you have to be more intelligent than that. You can come with something better.
I wouldn't come home. I
ain't gonna let you get away with that. No, you can't be that crazy. Now look, No, brother. Hey, I can't let you get away with that, man. I can't let you get away with something that stupid. Now look, you my friend. I love you.
Yeah, I'm with
you.
You're my friends. I'm just saying that I wouldn't even think of that craziness.
Thank you. Now, you know better than that. You know darn well you can come up with a better example than that. Come on now. I'm going to help you. Because, see, I love you. You know, I mean, I got to help you out because, you know what? You can't think very clearly. You know, I see that already.
That was an extreme example. That was an extreme example.
Right.
Very extreme.
Right.
We got all Reba on the line. Reba's raised three kids and she's got two grand. Reba, when your man or your sons are supposed to bring home the Pampers, okay, or doing whatever they got to do, let's hear from your... From a woman's point of view. Now, I gave a crazy example. I admit that.
You know what?
I gave a very crazy example.
You know, I wouldn't even say that with a straight face. I'm going to be honest with you, brother. But now, look, after she gets through, I'm going to give you some examples because you need some help.
Okay. Reba, you there?
Yes.
Reba, you there? All right, Reba.
Yes, I'm here.
All right, you're responsible. I've met Reba in person. We hung out for a day. Reba commands, she gives respect. Now, from a woman's point of view, is there any lingering, in your opinion, are there any lingering damages that might have happened that were initiated 200, 300, 400 years ago that were coming into effect today as far as your expectations of your man or one of your sons?
No, I just opportunity out here. You know, there are people who have paved the way to for us to have something like tennis. And I think a part of it is still, I think a part of the slave mentality is trying to live with white folks. If they don't want to live with you, don't live with them. Don't live near them. Don't live around them. You know, Black Wall Street was a successful operation. So just, you know, try to figure out who loves you and who doesn't. Because like you said, what were my expectations fails in my life? Starting with my inner, my close family circle, no excuses whatsoever. Don't sit around a round table talking about what you didn't let them do, because you're still giving them your money. Like Dr. Claude Anderson said, he said, unless you're buying these politicians, why are you marching? Figure out who to spend your money with and how to use that dollar, since that's what rules this world to a certain degree. Because love simply doesn't rule the world. We do.
Right.
Figure out how to make that money work for you. When they were buying slaves, they bought slaves with money. They used some currency to say, hey, this is what I'm going to leverage to get this or social capital, this physical labor or laborer. And to me, I started myself on your own business. A job is just
right.
over broken. To me, that's a form of slavery. You're still working for somebody else, and they're never going to pay you what you are worth. You can get out here in a real world and figure out how to value what you bring to the table and build on that and continue to build on that until the day you are a spirit first. When you do transition, you've left a legacy. Hey, I didn't just wait for somebody to do something for me. I went out here and I got it. And now my children and to come know how to get it done.
Right. Well, you raised three successful ones, so then you got two more that are you're helping with. But man, have you got a granddaughter yet? I know you got
so
a grandson.
Yes, yeah, Latino and Black as well. And we're probably French,
okay.
That's white in our blood. The reality is they're not going to have any excuses either, because they're going to see the example. A lot of times youth need to see the example. He built that house with his bare hands. They need to see that.
Right.
Whatever he used, there was no machine that built it. My grandfather built it. My father built it. And that's the legacy that I want to live as far as that goes, and to sustain property. Of course, I think a part of slave mentality as well is to say, okay, we have land, we just go sell it. And do what? Go sell your house back with the white man, really? You're going to sell your family legacy and do what? Want to live like them, which means what? Do you have access to the financial resources to go and really live like them? Or are you going to live like them like bad people? So, I've seen it done. I've seen people hit the lottery that were of African, and you're a millionaire and you're trying to live it up. You didn't spend all your money. I know it was basketball. I wanted to mention about Antoine Walker, who you haven't heard of, when my son was talking about, oh, basketball, this, basketball, that. Antoine Walker,
there's a lot of them.
He knows him personally. He met Antoine Walker. He was an NBA star who is now broke. And I can't just blame Child Support for that because he could have taken some of that money and invested and then say, okay, well, this residual income is going to pay that child support. Can't blame those baby mamas. Some of them wouldn't have to get some of that basketball money and call them basketball babies. But the reality is that, you know, resources out here. Even if you don't know how to fill out a job application or how to start your own business, there are resources out here. So figure it out. Plant your garden and refeed yourself.
All right, I agree with that. Now, Beasley, could you give some examples of people that have been damaged today?
I can give you 1,000 examples.
Well, we just need one or two.
But I'm going to give you just a few. Now, Reba said something that was very profound. She said that it's mental now. Mental slavery. And the thing is that, no, they don't have shackles around your ankles and around your neck. They have damaged you mentally. And let me give you something. Here's the deal. Are we still fighting for the right to vote? Are they trying to take away our right to vote? I'm looking at L.A.
Are you talking about on the federal level or local level or state level?
I don't give a damn what level I'm talking about. I'm talking about, are they trying to restrict black folks' right to vote?
Through redistricting, some people would say yes.
No. Answer the question, are they trying to restrict black folks' right to vote?
Beasley, that depends on what part of the country you're in.
I don't know what part of the country it is.
I think he means generally.
When they struck away, when they made the decision, Shelby versus Eric Holder, wasn't that a move to go in and restrict black folks' right to vote?
You talking about Eric Holder? You talking about Eric Holder out in California or the Eric Holder, the attorney general?
No, I'm talking about the attorney general. When the Supreme Court made that decision and took away the one part of the VRA, the Voters' Rights, what is it, the Voters' Rights Act? Weren't they making a move to restrict black folks' right to vote?
You know what? I don't know enough to comment on that, so honestly, I don't know.
Yes, you do. Now, come on. There's several, I don't know how many states have come in and put voting restrictions on people's right to vote. Come on, L.A. Don't filibuster me now. Don't filibuster me. Come on.
I don't know enough about it. So I made
you
a comment. I don't know nothing about it.
You know that they have passed laws to try and make it harder for black folks to vote. You look at the news just like I do. come on now. No, hey, look. Now, look. You dealing with Beasley, brother.
I know when it comes to ex-offenders, returning citizens,
I ain't talking about ex-offenders. You know what I'm talking about, L.A. Come on. Come on now, stop. Don't try to play me. I ain't gonna let you.
Enough about what you're talking about, though. I'm being honest with you.
Yes, you do. You know the states have passed some restrictive laws.
Well, yeah, I know. Like when it comes to like in Alabama, Mississippi, one of those two states. When it comes to abortion, they've been really restrictive on that.
I ain't talking about abortion. I'm talking about a simple casting your ballot. They have put restrictions out there, passed laws. They have passed laws to go in and try to restrict black folks' right to vote. Now, come on. You know it.
The problem with voting in the first place is that none of that helps black people on a general level anyway. It's like they're dishing out crumbs, like public aid and all this other kind of stuff. you're not really helping anybody. Public aid, I don't believe that black folk or anybody, you know, because you got white poor folk too. I don't believe that people should just be getting something. Just you get something because you're in a position of need. Work for what you need. Even if you're in a position of need, work for what you need.
Reba, it's a constitutional right. If you're a citizen, you have a constitutional right to go in and cast your ballot for who you want to represent you. And if those people are trying to restrict black folks' right to do that. Now, we can go all we want to, and we can go in and...
L.A., let me answer that question.
Beasley. Bianchi's been holding on for a while. Bianchi's been holding. Bianchi's mic is open. He's been holding for quite a long time. So, Bianchi, you got the floor.
The answer is no. Ain't nobody restricting no black, saying blacks can't vote. This court case, and you a damn fool. It ain't. Show me where they've been where they can't vote.
This court case in Alabama
is about redistricting. What, of course, is trying to get Alabama to segregate black people in one area. You mean to tell me that a black person that votes don't vote for whites? Are you crazy? What about mixed couples?
Listen, I didn't say they were trying to restrict black, stop black folks from voting. I said they were trying to restrict black folks from voting.
Ain't nobody trying to restrict black folks no more than anybody else. You mean to tell me that in these districts, whites don't live too? Huh? So are you saying that whites don't live in the district too? You crazy.
Didn't they pass the laws?
Nobody passed the law. How you going to pass a law that goes against the 15th Amendment? L.A., y'all need to stop falling for that crap.
No, you're a damn
idiot. All they do is confuse you.
No, you're confused. I got proof.
What law did they pass?
They passed all type of voter restriction laws.
All types. So if it's all types, that means there's a lot. That means you shouldn't have a difficult time naming one. Which one?
I can name several.
Name one.
All you got to do is look at the North Carolina law.
No, I ain't got to look at nothing. All you got to do is bring forth the evidence, which you don't do. You always try to throw on to somebody else to do your dirty work. Do your own dirty work. Bring forth.
I just told you North Carolina won a Supreme Court case for them trying to restrict black folks' votes.
Restrict black folks from voting how? And you know, here's another thing too. No state has to obey a Supreme Court opinion. Supreme Court don't make law.
That's right. And look, the only reason they can do that now is because they took out a key part of the Voter Registration Act. And you know it.
They've done away with Section 5 of the Voters Registration Act. The 1965 Voters Rights Act had nothing to do about voting. It was about registration. Fannie Lou Hamer said that herself. The 1965 Voters Rights Act, Section 5, was removed because those districts are now majority black. But you going to tell me that black is discriminating on themselves?
What was Section 5? Tell me what Section 5, what it was, and what it was.
Anytime a voting district went to move a poll from one side of the street to the other, they had to get pre-clearance from the Justice Department. That's totally ridiculous. Those districts are now all black. They are electing black candidates.
Why would they move a poll?
Across the street. Into a bigger building.
Answer the question. Why would they move a pole?
What did I say? What was my answer, L.A.?
To a bigger building.
Thank you.
That's a lot.
You're a damn liar. Well, okay, then why did they move the poll then? Why did they move the polling place?
That's why they were.
Why did they move the polling place? And regardless of that, and here's another thing. If blacks are so damn stupid to be caught up in slavery, that's their business. And you say they owe reparations. Well, here's the thing. What about the crimes that their ancestors committed on the African continent in those tribes? Those tribes are coming together having discussions about going to the world court to make sure that if these ancestors that done them harm receive reparations, they're going to put a lien against it. You owe them.
That is, well, let's put it this way. I would love to go in and adjudicate that case. I would love to do that because here's the deal. The tribes that sold our people as slavery, they did it with the understanding that it would be a slave system set up the way Africa is. They never saw their brothers and sisters to be in perpetual slavery. And you know it. The slavery
they sold the person to recoup. They sold the person to recoup restitution. And many of them didn't get a dime. So you still owe them. They don't care where the person was going to be used. They wanted the restitution. You still owe them.
Okay, if they sold me into slavery and they got and the slave traders gave them a valuable asset for exchange for my body to America, do they still have a case against me when they sold their rights off to the cracker?
It wasn't just whites that bought them, it was blacks too. And here's the thing.
Listen,
the sins of the father the son. You owe.
Listen, if they sold off their rights and I was property for them and they sold it to a new owner, do they still have rights to come in and ask for restitution?
Damn right, because if you owe $49, they only got 10. You still owe 39 multiplied by interest through all those years. Pay up.
You're a fool because
no, you're the fool,
right,
and you're an old
give a
ass
damn,
fool.
I don't
like
give
that.
A damn how much. I don't give a damn.
I don't give a damn either. You're lying. You owe
right.
money.
It's on the right, and you know it. And a matter
you
of
owe
case,
money.
I don't give a damn. If
you owe money. We'll take your old ass back. We'll take a nap. You owe money.
They have no legal right. They have no legal right if they sold their rights under the price of what they felt like my body was valuable for, and you know it.
You burned their huts. You raped their women. You killed the children. You stole the cattle. You owe.
And when they saw me for under the value,
well, let's call it even. How about that? Because none of those systems, call it even then. Somebody might want to say, hey, everybody's entitled to their opinion. Call it even. We don't owe them nothing. They don't owe us nothing. Unless black people take your dollars. Well, hey, I think they owe us way more than we owe them. And mind you, I'm part white, too, so. Beg to differ. I'm part French. So now, the reality is that none of those systems work, so black people should go and live by themselves and take your money with you. Start a whole new life, take all your people and go somewhere else and live by yourself, and let's see how they do without our money. How about that?
We empower the green dollar
because we move that money way faster
than
they
do. Yeah, but
who
do you work
it's
for?
It's been proven. I don't work for no white man.
What are you talking about?
I work for God.
Let's talk about
I work for God. Let's talk about
who
I work for.
Who do they work for?
Who do they work for?
All those STEM graduates. All them National Society of Black Engineers STEM graduates work for white companies. They don't work for no black companies.
And they still, you know, I agree, you know, the mentality, back to that slave mentality, why do all these so-called intellectual blacks, not only do they argue with one another about what is that going to do? Keep in mind, as we're so intelligent, so why don't we educate those
you know
that
what?
Are
you
not
absolutely
educated?
Right. Guess what?
And
you're
then they
right,
can't
Lisa.
Help black folk from getting shot and killed out here. So all these PhDs and master's
degrees. Look at all the black Look at all the in less than how many days? In less than 80 some odd days, you done had over 100 and some odd blacks shot by other blacks with 89 killed in Chicago. Who's going to pay them families reparations? Those blacks?
You don't believe in reparations. You don't believe in reparations. But
maybe they do, though.
You know what?
But maybe, they do.
Because we got a bunch of Uncle Toms like the one talking. Like he wants
you can
to
say whatever the hell you want. I'm going to ask you this question. You talk about why. You talk about how the white man whipped your ass. What you going to do about it? You ain't going to do nothing.
Hey.
They whooped your ass. They raped your face. What you going to do about it? You're not going to do a damn thing.
Have you seen me in front of a court of law? Well, somebody strikes me, I tell you what, see where they land. That's all I got to take.
All you gonna do is beg.
People out here that are killing other people, I think that their families, while they're incarcerated, I feel like, first of all, black folks should police their own communities, because if we killing each other off, we don't need no extra people killing us off, okay? And I'm like I said, I don't claim all
black
just my black ethnicity. I claim my other ethnicity as well. Yeah.
Let me ask you a question, Reed. You gonna police your own community. So you go to put handcuffs on somebody and they say you hurt their wrist and they gonna
That's
sue
not
you.
Policing.
What you gonna
no,
do
that's
then?
That's the white man's policing. We got a way of policing.
What do you mean by policing your own community?
I'm gonna answer the question when you pause. Okay, when you pause I'm gonna share. Now the reality is that we have in certain communities, we have black men that watch the community block by block, know what's going on, and I agree with Nosy Neighbors because it helped me when I got my divorce. However, reality is that you know what's going on in your own community. You know who's coming in and out of your community. You also know what little such and such as little child is out here and their mamas and daddies not watching them. And also these brothers hold the fathers accountable, okay? And that just needs to be multiplied on a higher scale. Because when it comes down to it, how are you a common citizen required somebody else to do something?
You don't have no jurisdiction over a common citizen.
Because we're talking about people that are people. When you're talking about jurisdiction, that's from the justice system that don't include blacks. It's a justice. It does include blacks. It does not work for blacks. Black people are never recognized as a whole man.
How are you going to police your own community? Because it starts by trying.
It starts by an effort.
LA, can you help me out with that?
Well, I'm the one who said it.
Let me say this here. You're talking to somebody that's not a real man. Now, when I was in Baltimore, we had a situation like that. We patrolled our area, and we made sure somebody wasn't doing what they were supposed to do. We stepped to them. But when you're talking to a sellout like the one that's talking, see, he is scared of his own shadow, and he's scared of his own race. And he's denying
you know what?
Yeah,
you ain't got a dime to lose or a pot to piss in. You ain't got nothing to lose. Somebody sue your damn ass.
Well, it all matters on what you're talking about. I got just as much as you got.
Because I tell you what, if I was in Baltimore and you came up and laid your hands on me, I'm suing your ass. I'm suing you for every damn thing you got. I'm gonna try to get. To show you what
blacks,
I think about
generally
your
blacks have more intellect than that, so somebody has to put their hands on you just because they're talking to you. A lot of times, you know, a lot of these so-called criminal men, and I'm going to be honest with you, I got experience from Tinley Park, if you know what that is, and it's a mental health hospital. It's closed down now. Some people can shut a mental institution down. So from all intellectual levels, spiritual, mental, you name it, psychological, emotional trauma from the highest elevation, to intellect and spiritual intellect and insight. Let me finish my point so you can understand where I'm coming from. See, everything that I've experienced personally ain't just for me. The things that I've seen and the places
that's
that
right.
I've been ain't just for me. So the reality is
that's
that, right. I mean, because when I first picked up, got on the call, I was hearing, and it kind of sound personal. It's okay for us, even in small circles, to say, okay, well, I do value your opinion. I want to hear what you're saying. And I got I'm concerned about how you feel
well,
about
I
something.
Do value
but that doesn't
your
mean.
Opinion.
No, 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 but what I'm
opinion.
Saying is I made a comment. I made a comment
in
and
a
I,
court of law.
I don't care about these so-called courts because they don't always. Well, I was arrested
well,
illegally.
You are, then Reba,
let me
tell
you something. I was
yourself.
Arrested. Let me tell you something. I don't know who I'm speaking to because y'all voices kind of sound similar, to be honest
you
with you. But I'm going to say this.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to say this.
I don't
let,
sound
let me
like
respond.
That damn diesel.
Okay, I'm going to respond. I was arrested for something that I was accused of by a white skinhead cop, I'm going to call him, and I had never been arrested before. When I say this particular Just ICE system, ICE to me is translated to Just Us. There is no reason why someone who has never committed a crime should be handcuffed and treated like a criminal, boxed up with criminals.
Well, what happened?
And then told
what,
that
the,
I,
what the cop done didn't have nothing to do with justice. That was enforcement.
Well, it wasn't.
You got to know the
no,
difference.
No, enforcing.
What
wait,
when
wait,
you
wait,
went
wait,
to
wait,
court?
Wait. Let me ask
minute,
you something. You
wait
ain't got
a
break.
What
you ain't got
to
about
court?
It.
The woman
you, okay.
The woman
so
court,
it was enforcement
oh,
of what?
Up,
enforcement. Wait. Let me ask you a question because you're speaking on something that you did not experience. But you said
well,
it was enforcement. What were they enforcing? No. What were they enforcing?
The enforcement is when he put the handcuffs on you to detain you. Now, the justice would have been
enforcing
when you went
what?
To court. What
enforcing
happened when you went to court?
What was the enforcement?
It had to be something because he detained you. But the, you
oh,
said
really?
It wasn't justice.
Oh, wow. Wait.
Wait a minute.
Slow down.
You said
just hear
it
what
was
you
not justice. Justice would
okay.
have been when
feel-
you went to court.
Okay, you're trying to explain
five.
Something. You okay, I understand. I got a law background, a lie background. I got all that, too. So I
well,
want to ask
you
this. Did you hear what you just said? Did you hear what you just said? They were enforcing what? Answer your own question. Enforcing what?
I was not there.
Oh,
thank
there you go.
You
there
were the
you
one
go.
Said they put handcuffs on
you. There you go.
Then you
so,
said,
so back
wait
it up.
A minute, wait a minute.
Back it up. I don't,
did you
I don't need
say
to yell.
That,
I'm excited, too.
That the cop put, did you say the cop put handcuffs on you?
Illegally, yes.
All right, so if it was illegally and if you was going to seek due process justice, you would have went to court. So what
it's
happened
not
when you
if.
Went to court?
It's not if, and calm down. Well, nobody getting too excited. Now, the reality is that when I went to the Just ICE system, it was already set up that I could be arrested. Just like they killed Sandra Bland, they thought they could kill me, but I was educating too many people when I went in there. So just to give you a brief history on that, yeah, God wanted me to be in there so I can see the real deal.
Well, let me say something.
God
because
wanted me to see it. And yes,
Bland.
They held me
all
until they
people,
couldn't help me no longer. And they asked me to plead guilty. That's what you
right,
didn't
well,
mean.
You
they
did
wanted
go
me
to
plead
court.
Guilty
that
like they
just,
do. Well, I don't even call it court. I call it
court.
I call it a stage for drama. It was not a real court. The judge
all
was
right,
corrupt.
All right, we hear that. All
the,
right, you was innocent. They done you wrong. Okay, we agree to that. But
well,
you talk
no,
about
God did me right. I'm just
I,
saying.
God
you asked,
done
I told
you right. The Heavenly Father wait. Done you right. The angels were singing. That's right. Good.
There you go.
But
so
you
now
talk
you
about
said
Sandra
enforcement.
Bland,
I just want you to stand corrected
so
because you're in error. They weren't enforcing anything because I didn't do anything wrong.
All right.
I was
they
doing
wasn't enforcing
right.
anything. It was the I-justice system, injustice, and all that stuff. I agree with that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't. I was doing
all
something right,
now,
so they arrested
you said
me. So
about
you educated
Sandra Bland. You said
yep.
something about Sandra Bland. The people
yep.
that complain about Sandra Bland, they should have came together and put up $500 to get out of
they
jail.
They sure
but,
should
oh,
have.
No, they did
because they
not.
Didn't even come and get me. I was there for 2 whole weeks. You're right. That's just out. And then we got a sister named Jaguar Wright that's locked up to this day. Now, she has had some mental trauma that she's admitted. She's not mentally ill. She actually is a multi-million-dollar songwriter. Jill Scott is one of the artists that she writes for. Now, she's a ghostwriter, so you guys won't necessarily know everybody who she writes for, but I know Jill Scott is one of them. But Jill Scott wears that face because she was a sellout.
Well, I don't know no Jill Scott. Never heard of her.
Well,
Ellie,
well,
did you get my email?
You probably heard of Whitney Houston.
Did you get my emails, Ellie?
You probably heard of Whitney Houston.
I got to read them.
Okay, so I don't know if Doc is still on the line, Brother L.A. Can he make his announcement?
Yeah. Hold on. What's his number?
He is calling, I think, 224.
Okay, hold on. Let me open up his mic. I was wondering. Well, hold it. Anybody there? Or did the call drop?
Doc, you should have him on three-way. Oh, we went off the air?
Oh, wait a minute. No. We're still here.
Okay, do you see
224? Let me open up his mic. Yeah, I see it. 224, your mic is open.
I'm still here, though.
Awesome.
Mic is open. 224, your mic is open. Yes, hello, we can hear you. What's your announcement?
Oh, I just want to let people know about
224.
Can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead with your announcement. Yeah, we can hear you.
Yes. I just want everybody to know about June 23rd. It's a fundraiser dinner at the Grand Ballroom. We got Whitney Houston impersonator and Tina Turner impersonator, plus 1 hour open bar, and we got food for everybody as well. And the tickets is on sale right now on Eventbrite.com. Eventbrite.com, CNE fundraiser dinner. If you go on Eventbrite, you can purchase your tickets. So, yeah, that's my
announcement. Okay. All right, that's coming up soon, so we need to push that out there every day and whatnot. So, okay, well, Reba, we're going to let you have the last word of the day. You got 1 minute. Oops. So Reba, you there? Okay, well.
Yes, I'm
you
here.
The last
Go ahead.
Word Hey, you got the last word of the day. You got last word of the day. You got 90 seconds.
Who, me?
Yeah.
Okay, last thanks. Word. So, yes. So, this I'm inviting all black investors. This is a Black Investors Dinner, as I'm calling it. We're going to be at the Grand Ballroom June 23rd, 2023, Friday, June 23rd. That's next week. This is an investment opportunity where you are – You'll be set and educated to be able to get a double return on your investment. We are building Star City as the producer of the event, Doc said. Vendors are invited. They can call 773-449-8839. Again, the number is 773-449-8839. And the vendor tables are only $50 donation. This is a fundraising dinner, a Black Investors invite, so spread the word. And certainly share the number, FastNowEntertainment.com.
All right. See you guys tomorrow.
All right. Thanks.